This is LOA Today, the Law of Attraction Show.
Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Peason here with my brother Mark and my sister-in-law Yona on this Thursday, March 12th, 2015. And today we thought we would kind of change it up a little bit and talk about how to apply the law of attraction in the little things that occur in our everyday lives. For instance, a few days back, I had a conversation with a friend and told him that my wife Louise and I have this ability to influence the weather. And specifically, now I'm living in Connecticut. Louise and I are living in Connecticut right now. Of course, we're in the middle of all this snow that's been going on for the last month or so, along with the rest of New England and New York and much of the northern parts of the country. And interesting event happened today. If you looked at the radar on AccuWeather.com or Weather.com or one of those, and you know saw what the colorized map would show you, virtually all of New England and large portions of Long Island and New York and so forth were covered with this massive snowstorm. And indeed, reports were coming in from all over, except here. Now, the AccuWeather did show that we were getting snow. And in fact, the reports were saying that snow will end in 2 hours or something like that. We got no snow today.
Wow.
None whatsoever. I mean, not even a flake. And not 2 days ago, Louise and I were talking about, well, her business is a gardening business. That's her main business. And she wants to get that going, which means the snow has to melt and the temperatures have to rise and we have to stop getting more snow. So we were putting out there thoughts about, you know, nice warm temperatures, sunny blue skies, all that kind of stuff. And lo and behold, we're getting no snow when the AccuWeather is telling us we're getting snow. Now, I would say that qualifies as some pretty strong LOA. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. So how far away from you is actually getting snow?
I do know that we're near the town of Simsbury, which is about 10, 15 miles north of Hartford. About 10 miles west of Hartford is Southington, and that's where my friend lives. And he was getting snow today.
Oh, okay.
So good.
It wasn't far.
That's good. The ski resort got snow, which I'm sure they want, and you got no snow, which is what you want.
Well, I'm not sure that you can call it a resort. I mean, Mount Southington is probably like 500 feet high if it's an inch. We're not talking about this major mountain here.
Well, I'm sure that's a record for Connecticut. So.
But they're not exactly up in the hills. They're probably pretty much the same latitude we are. So we can't really explain it that way. But nice try, though. I like that.
So when next you see this guy, you're going to remind him, or are you going to share with him? I mean, is he aware of your powers?
Oh, yeah. Well, we were talking by phone today. And actually,
talk to him. Okay.
Yeah, and this came up in the conversation. I told him about the history that Louise and I have controlling the weather. And, in fact, we've been able to do it for quite some years now. Mm-hmm. Much to our surprise, to say the least, dating back to before we even understood or heard the term law of attraction.
Right.
In fact, Mark, you may remember back, I believe it was the year actually that Louise and I got married. Yes. We'd been visiting down at the lake, remember, in Virginia, where our parents had property. And that particular year, there was a hurricane off the coast of the United States.
I
can't remember what the name of the hurricane was, but it centered over North and South Carolina and just stayed there. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. And it was threatening to come inland.
Right.
And there was forecast about where it was going to come inland, and it didn't, did it?
It didn't. No, it stayed there our entire time there. And I realized later the reason it stayed there is that I put out there that I wanted us to have a nice sunny week, you know, doing our jet skiing and so forth on Smith Mountain Lake in Virginia, and the weather obeyed me. And the way I know for sure that the weather obeyed me is that when Louise and I left after that week and drove back home, the storm followed us up the coast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think it finally went up north to North Atlantic, didn't it?
It did, yep. Yeah. But only after we let it. And at the time, I just thought that was weird. I didn't think that that was actually something I really controlled. I thought it was just one of those weird coincidences. But after that, of course, we moved to Virginia and lived there for 11 years. And during that time, particularly when we were in Northern Virginia,
there were a lot of storms that would come through, tornadoes. There were a lot of tornadoes came, particularly up Route 29 and throughout the area. There were major thunderstorms at times. You know, some of them were pretty damaging. Lots of wind, trees would come down, and so on and so forth. Inevitably, we'd get wind, if you'll forgive the pun, we would get wind of one of these storms coming through, and I would check AccuWeather and see, uh-oh, there's a big major storm cell, and it's heading right to where our house is, because I could always tell where on the map our house was.
Right.
So I say, okay, Louise, here we go. We got to put the weather out of our path, because right now there's this major storm bearing down on us. So we would get to work and just do our little thing and put out there that we wanted to have blue skies and sunny weather and nice warm temperatures, you know, no winds or anything, just really beautiful little white puffy clouds and all that kind of stuff. And then we would observe what happened to the storm. And inevitably, I can't think of an exception, in fact, inevitably, you could watch the AccuWeather, and you know how they have the I guess you'd call it a heat map. It's a map that shows you where the storms are, and they apply colors to tell you how severe the storms are and so forth.
Yeah.
Inevitably, as that map came toward where our house was, it would start to break up and form a hole around our house.
Wow.
And indeed, you could walk outside the house, and if you looked out, you know, at the treetops and so forth, you could see the trees blowing around, but nothing would actually ever happen at our property. And then after a storm was over, particularly if it was a bad storm, you know, major thunderstorms or a tornado came through or something like that, we would go out and drive, you know, to the Route 29, you know, the nearest highway and see what was going on. We'd get two or three blocks away, major damage all over the place. But in our neighborhood, nothing, you know, like an occasional branch or two. That was about it. So that's when we realized that we have this pattern going on. We're able to do this.
Yes, you guys have superpowers.
Superpowers, yeah.
Our weather whisperers.
We're still trying to figure out how you do it with everything else in life, but we yes. got weather down pretty good.
Good, yeah.
Weather in parking places, we're pretty good at those too. And in fact, you guys should remember when your family came, you on it. Remember that trip we went into D.C.?
Yes, I do. Yeah, and we tried getting parking for getting into the train station.
And let me tell you, anyone who's ever been to the D.C. area, Northern Virginia, and tried to get into the metro station during the work week and find a parking place, you know how difficult that can be.
Yes.
It is not an easy thing. And yet somehow, miraculously, through our ability to attract them, we all put out the positive vibes. And lo and behold, we got the last two parking places in the entire lot.
Yeah, there was something... my memory is very vague, but
there was another car there in front of
us.
Two of them, actually. There were two cars.
There were two cars, right. And they were hesitating whether to go in or not because the lot said lot full.
Right.
And we drove around them and went in and got the last two spots.
That's right. We had the faith just to go in there and look.
Right. Because they were staying there standing and discussing it. And
right.
I remember
that's
that.
Right. Yep.
And we just went by past them and got the parking spot.
That was so funny.
It was funny. It was amazing. It was miraculous, and it was perfect timing.
It was.
Because I'm not sure how well we would have. I mean, I don't really want to try to put my parking abilities to the test by doing it inside DC. That's even harder.
But it should be all the same to the higher power, you know.
It actually is. Yeah. It's oh me of little faith.
Yep.
Yeah, in fact, you said something like that at the introduction to the show about making small influences on the universe. And I remember thinking, reminded me of the Star Wars movie where Yoda chastised Luke Skywalker for saying, well, it's so big. And he goes, size doesn't matter. Judge me by my size.
He also said, try, you do not try. You do or you do not. There is no other.
There's no try. That's right. Yeah.
So I've been practicing lately the art of doing.
Doing, yes. Just doing.
And I kind of throw in, I juxtapose what Abraham Hicks has taught about that the only doing to be done is to get yourself into a positive frame of mind and stay there and then put your wishes out, what they call the rockets of desire. Into your vortex or you know, the universe or your higher self or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
That's the work. It makes me sweat, to be honest.
I know we came across a statement, something to that effect, that said, all we have to do is to exercise our faith in the direction of what we want or what we're wanting.
I've always been glad that the faith part of it only required the size of a mustard seed, because I had trouble getting anything bigger than that. I mean, that was a lot for me, you know.
Well, you've certainly developed the faith about influencing the weather.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't really understand how I did that. I wish I could sit here and tell you that I am a weather-influencing guru, but that's just something that sort of happened, and I said, what did I do? Yeah. The only thing I can say for sure is I do know that in those instances where I was successfully influencing the weather, there were two factors that always held true, three factors actually that always held true. The first factor was that I felt good. Mm-hmm. I just felt really confident and really sure of myself. Oh, by the way, another example of the weather, and Mark, you'll remember this one. Okay. Back in, this is the same year as those storms down in Virginia. This is the year that Louise and I got married. In February of that year, on Valentine's Day, that's the day I asked her, would you marry me? And she said yes. February 14, 1999. Within weeks after that, we're planning the wedding because her father was in very poor health. And he and Louise's stepmother asked, when were we planning to do the wedding? And we figured, well, probably in about a year. And her father said, if you can do it sooner than that, I'm not sure I can be here that long. Right. So we said, oh, okay. So we decided to do it in September of that year, September 26th. And Louise was really concerned because that's hurricane season, right, or at least it's the end of it. And so the question was, well, you know, what do we do if we don't have, you know, really nice weather? Well, we found a venue. It's a country club, or it used to be a country club. I think it's actually closed now. But we found this venue that was really nice, and they did have an inside facility. So if all else failed, we could do everything inside. But we really wanted to have the outside ceremony. And somehow I got in my mind, again, this is before I knew what the law of attraction was, but somehow I got in my mind that I was bound and determined I was going to get us a beautiful day to get married on. And so I did. And ultimately, the way I did it was I got myself feeling really good about it. I just felt confident it was going to happen. And then once I got into that feeling place, I put my request out. I want a bright blue sky, red, you know, sunny day, little puffy clouds, all that kind of thing, warm weather, comfortable, where people can sit outside. They don't need to wear coats or anything like that. And just, you know, really, really nice weather for the day. And then I did the most important thing of all. I forgot about it.
Yeah.
I forgot about it. So I did the three things that you needed to do. I got myself into the happy frame of mind. I put out the request, and then I removed it from my mind.
Yeah.
And that's what made the difference, I'm sure now. Now, within years after that, I learned about the law of attraction, and I asked myself, how did I do it? And it took me a long time to realize that those were the factors that were involved. I didn't get that at first. But as we started to analyze, Louise and I started to analyze all the different times we had influenced weather, we finally realized those were the factors that were always true. And lo and behold, of course, that is basically how you're supposed to do the law of attraction. So, you know, one in one place makes three, right?
Right. So. Yeah, just rinse and repeat.
That's right. Wash, rinse, and repeat. Exactly.
But interestingly, you mentioned that you forgot about it. And, you know, I think that the forgetting about it is key in that it helps you not to send any contradictory fourth energy out. You know what I mean?
Precisely.
Yep, don't worry.
Yep.
So the challenge is when we have these issues that we're trying to, you know, influence or control, is actually forgetting about it. Or if forgetting about it is not an option because it comes to you every day, being always positive so that you're not sending out any, you know, because, you know, some LOA teachers, they always talk about, when you desire it from a happy, confident place, you're attracting it to you or you to it. But the minute you start doubting, you start pushing it away, or you yourself are getting further and further away from what you're actually wanting. And correct. So that's what forgetting about it allows all the energy that you send out to be only positive, desiring, intentional energy. And so that's the challenge that happens when we, the problem is we try to use the LOA on things that are so important to us.
Mm-hmm.
That we can't forget
we
about.
We can't forget about.
Yeah.
Faces
yeah.
us every day.
Exactly.
You know?
And you're right. You're exactly right. That's why forgetting, if you can forget about it, that's why it's the best policy, because you don't end up focusing on negatives. And that's really important, because we are all creatures of our society, and our society has taught us 1,001 different ways to look at things negatively, and so we are very skilled at it.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And as a result of being very skilled at it, the moment that anything new comes into our mind that becomes important to us, and we start thinking about it more and more, the more likely we're going to find negative ways to dwell on that thing, whatever it might be. That's
right.
Why, like you pointed out, that's why the attachment basically turns sour. And we ended up driving the thing away rather than attracting it. So you're absolutely right. I agree entirely.
So,
it's quite daunting, actually. The one thing I have noticed most recently, and I'm trying to apply it on things that are really, really important to me, is the importance of telling the positive story in the face of the negative story.
Yes, I think that is key.
Because that's what we do. We create all these horrible negative scenarios about this stuff that we're looking for to attract into our lives, and all the different things that can go wrong, and then all the other things that can go wrong in life, and blah, 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 and pretty soon we're in a negative track. And once you recognize that that happens, your first step is, well, recognize it. And so you've accomplished that first step. Okay, yeah, I'm being negative all the time in my head. I don't like that, but I'm not sure what to do about it yet. But at least you got the first step. That is recognizing that it happened. The second step is to replace the story. And that's where it gets a little bit trickier. Because you're so used to focusing your mind in all these little negative ways. And now you've got to replace it with a made-up story about things working out good.
Yes. And that is it. Because if you keep trying to figure out how is it going to happen, how exactly is this going to work out, what am I going to do, what's required of me, you're always going to go down the path of the, you know, all the negative cautions, the watch outs, whatever.
Exactly.
If you try to think in terms of this thing already happening, and think how you will feel when it happens, and what this wonderful event, circumstances is going to mean to you and to your life and to your loved ones, and you know, you just try to focus on that every time the doubt and the the negative thoughts come to your mind. You try to focus only on the event already happening, already taking place. So you project yourself into the future, and you focus on that story, and you let that kind of be the dominant movie that you run in your mind. Every time that the doubt comes in, you try to run that scene, that script, and that, you know, helps to kind of quell the fears. It's harder doing it than talking about it.
Yes. Yeah. And it's amazing how, on the one hand, it's a very subtle distinction.
Yes.
And on the other hand, it's almost a chasm of distinction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the difference is what frame of mind you're in.
If I may, I think the difference is the reason it's subtle is because it seems subtle, especially from the conventional mindset, but it's a chasm once you can achieve that happy place in the midst of in the face of the negative fears, if you will. because you can really only feel one or the other. You're either feeling either slightly or very afraid of the negative outcome, or you're feeling confident and happy about a positive outcome.
Yeah.
You really can't be in the same place at the same time.
That's true.
And that's what makes it such a chasm, I think.
And by the way, I just realized I never actually finished the story. We had beautiful weather on the wedding.
Yes.
It was gorgeous.
It was gorgeous. I remember.
So, yeah. I don't know about the chasm thing. Sometimes I find that if I'm in the most negative spot, that's where the chasm seems biggest to me. And when I'm in the most positive spot, that's when the difference seems so subtle. But I suspect that it's going to be different for every person. Every person's going to perceive it differently.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So I don't know. What other stuff have you guys tried to attract in your life and either not gotten the result you were looking for or gotten the result?
Well, we influence the weather by moving.
Yes, you found the best way to influence it.
I guess that sort of kind of counts.
Oh, it definitely counts.
Oh, weather, we didn't want what was in Ohio, so we moved to Florida. Now we have a different weather.
In fact, if I can introduce a somber note, I can give an example of the other way of looking at it, you know, the negative way of looking at it, and how it has played out drastically badly for people. Mm-hmm. One of the big, probably the biggest criticism of the whole concept of the law of attraction is the idea that we are responsible for attracting everything into our own lives.
Yes.
And that's as true for a baby in the womb and for an infant and for a child as it is for an adult. And it's even true in cases where horrible things happen to people. And probably the classic example that's always given is, well, what about the Holocaust? I mean, how can you possibly say that that was a case of the law of attraction? And on the surface, it's hard to answer the question because there's so much emotion attached to that, and it's all very negative emotion, very powerful, very potent, that trying to get past that can be very challenging. But as one particular guru explained it, and I thought that she did a very nice job, if you look at what individuals did in that case, it becomes more clear. For instance, there were a lot of Jewish people who left Europe. They could see the handwriting on the wall. It wasn't terribly subtle. I mean, it was pretty clear that the people who were coming into power in Germany hated Jews. We're not talking about slight dislike. We're not talking about occasionally, you know, causing a little problem on a street corner. They were out to get them. And not just Jews, there were actually a number of different minority groups, if you will, that they were after, but Jews were at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. A lot of Jewish people saw that handwriting on the wall and said, we're leaving, and their most popular place to go was America. Some went to Australia, some went to Canada, some went to other places, but mostly to America. So quite clearly, those people took the same kind of action you took. They went for the more positive climate to live in, mm-hmm. not in this case a weather climate, but a political climate. Whereas the people who stayed, they insisted, no, I'm not leaving my home. I've lived here. We've lived here for generations. We're not leaving no matter what, are the ones who died.
Yes. And, you know, that just reminded me. I just reread a couple of days ago, Who Moved My Cheese?
Oh, yeah.
And that is so, you know, relevant to what you're talking about, and it applies to just not, you know, to the Holocaust, but just so many things in your life, whether it's a job or the place where you live or whatever situation you find yourself in. There are always going to be those who feel like, well, I didn't do anything wrong, I'm a good person, and so my cheese should always be here, and if it's not, I'm going to stay here until it comes back, because that's just the way it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other guy in the story said, you know what, so what, the cheese has moved, I got to move on, I got to go find new cheese. And, you know, that guy, in going on the journey, he discovers things about himself, he learns, he grows, and he gets to understand how the world works a whole lot better. And you know, it just reminds us sometimes that, you know, we so easily fall into the victim mentality. In some things we feel very powerful, but in other things we tend to think, well, you know what, this is the way it should be, and I'm going to stay here until it returns to the way it should be, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we refuse to realize that we have the power to change the situation or go to a new environment, and thereby, as a result, change the situation as well. So we always have options. We're always more powerful than we realize.
That we are more powerful than we realize. The other objection that I know gets made a lot along the same lines is, well, okay, you can make this argument that people should have left, but for the people who stayed, or even let's go back to the whole question of the infant in the womb or that kind of thing, you know, somebody being born with, you know, cerebral palsy or something like that, how can you possibly claim that they attracted that? Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I want to say is more like an argumentative rebuttal, but on the other hand, I don't know another way to go at it, so that's why I say it. What I say is, how do you know they didn't? Where's your evidence? You assume that because they're innocent children, that they're innocent infants, that nothing like that was going on in their heads, but how do you really know? And ultimately, I guess we don't really know either way. So it becomes one of those pain points to talk about, just because we want to talk about a pain point, we want to shoot down the other side. And of course, that's all very counterproductive. But ultimately, it's very difficult to know. It's actually, I think for all of us, it's impossible to know what goes on inside the heads of fetuses inside the mother's womb. We don't know what's going on inside there. We have assumptions we make, but we don't really know. So can we prove or disprove the whole concept of the law of attraction by looking at that particular example? I don't see how.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we, you know, we project a lot, you know. So as adults, we see things as being very difficult and you know, think of it as intense suffering and pain. But it's not always necessarily that case, you know. And mm-hmm. That's how I tend to think about it. And I have grown to that understanding, because I am someone who I tended to empathize a lot. I you know, it was a trait that I was born with, unfortunately. And yeah, I felt other people's pain, you know, and at one point I was like angry, like, why do I feel other people's pain? And I realized that I was projecting my own pain onto them. So whenever I would see someone who was blind or disabled or had some kind of, you know, malady of some sort, I would feel so much empathy for them, and I would feel badly and want to help them. And I realized, you know, as I got older, that the situation that I thought was such a terrible situation is not necessarily a terrible situation. I've come to understand that these people who may have physical disabilities have other abilities that, you know, that makes their life even richer than me or other people who have all their physical, you know, senses. And so I realized that, you know, I was projecting all of these bad sufferings onto these people, which wasn't necessarily the case. And I think we tend to do that a lot, especially for children who, you know, fetuses, babies, innocent children that we see, and we're thinking, you know, this is such a terrible situation, and what, why is it that they're suffering? It couldn't be. But, you know, there are things that happen in the universe that we don't have the answers to. You know, there's natural stuff and supernatural stuff, and sometimes we're not privy to all the supernatural forces that are at play and why certain things happen the way they do.
You make a really, really good point, the whole idea of projection. Yes. And there's actually an arrogance to that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever thought about that, but there's an arrogance to projection. And the arrogance basically suggests, I know better than the person I'm projecting on how they're feeling.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, yes. Yeah.
I don't think most people think of that when they're, I mean, we consider it to be a positive trait if you have empathy for somebody else.
Right, yes.
And I think largely it is a positive trait, provided that you use it for your own health.
Yes.
For your own, in a good, positive way. But as with any tool, you can also use it negatively, and you can cause harm more to yourself than to anybody else, although you can cause harm to somebody else too. But mainly it's harm to yourself. And that, I think, is what you were describing. I think that's why you said it was unfortunate for you to have that kind of empathy. I think, actually, it's very fortunate for you to have that empathy, especially since you've now learned how to use it properly.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, as a child and as a teenager, it was not fun.
No, it's not fun. Well, it's like what Louise calls, you know, the 2x4 lesson.
Right, exactly.
Sometimes life just insists that you have to learn by the 2x4, but actually it isn't life, it's you insisting it.
Yeah, but yeah, so that's the whole thing. Yeah, and I still don't have the answers to the people who say, you know, that LOA can't be true if innocent children, you know, are made to suffer. So,
well, strictly speaking, the answer, if they were honest with themselves, and they're not going to be in many cases, but if, in those cases where they're willing to be honest with themselves, the strictly true answer is they don't know any more than we do what's going on there, so therefore they cannot know that it disproves the law of attraction theory.
Right. You could, you know, if you could disprove the law of attraction with that concept, you can disprove any religious belief or any metaphysical belief.
Right.
Because until you know, you don't know.
That's right. I mean, the biggest fraud, if you will, that takes place in the world of logic and reason is the fraud that says, if you perceive something to be not true, therefore you know it to not be true.
Right.
And that's simply not true.
One subject I never liked in school, actually.
I love that one.
No, of course.
Yes, I would. And you wouldn't.
I wouldn't.
And for me, it's my left brain doing battle with my right brain, and I keep saying, look, guys, we got to get along here. That's what's so fascinating to me. I mean, maybe you want to, you could, well, actually, we're way over time for a break. Let's take a break. And then after the break, maybe you could take a few moments to talk about the whole left brain, right brain thing, and we can tie that into this whole discussion of how we attract things. Is that something you think you could address for us?
Sure.
Okay. This is LOA Today here on PRN. We'll be back. Welcome back to LOA Today. Walt, Mark, and Yumona on this Thursday, March 12, 2015, talking about the little things in life that we can attract. And somehow we got talking about the really big and heavy duty things that can be, you know, quite gruesome and difficult and so forth. But as so often happens with these discussions, we kind of go off in a variety of directions. During the break, Yuona, you made a really interesting point, which is the argument I was making about how people who doubt the law of attraction say, well, the Holocaust and infants and all that kind of stuff are proof that LOA can't be true, and how you would never make that point because they wouldn't react well to it. I agree, they wouldn't react. In fact, I'd point out they wouldn't react well to anything. Because when you're in a mindset that says A can't be true and you have emotional attachment to it, nothing anyone else is going to say is going to change your mind.
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
And that's just the fact of life. So if we've offended people who are listening, we apologize for the offense. Not much we could do about that other than just to keep our mouths shut, I suppose. But then again, it wouldn't be an entertaining program if we did that. So we were talking just before the break about left brain versus right brain, and you want to, let's tie in your scientific expertise. Give us some clues about how that affects this whole perception of the law of attraction.
So, you know, a disclaimer first, there is a school of thought that said there is really no such thing as left brain, right brain, but...
Okay. Well, we should talk about that too in a moment, but go ahead.
Right. But generally speaking, the left brain is associated with, you know, the logical thinking, problem solving, and just kind of finding solutions to problems. Whereas the right brain, finding solutions that are logical, of course, the right brain is more associated with creativity and, you know, exploring options. But interestingly, you know, that book that was written by the neuroscientist who had a stroke, stroke of insight,
right.
Jill Bolte Taylor. She talked about how, you know, during her recovery from the stroke, she was able to understand the part of her brain that was actually damaged and incapacitated by the stroke. You know, she had a major blood vessel burst, and so there was, you know, no blood going mainly to the left side of her brain. And so she lost the ability to do math and to think like a scientist.
To understand
speech and language, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, yeah. But interestingly, so her right brain now was the brain that was in charge or in control of her life. And so what she felt was this absolute connection to everything. She felt love and she felt peace and she felt joy. And it gave her an insight, which, you know, science has already proven that, you know, that's what the right brain is responsible for. The thing is that in our society, it's part of, you know, the educational process and, you know, training and exam and jobs and everything that you are required to be successful in our world is left brain oriented, especially in the industrialized nations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a TED talk, and you've seen that about how, you know, we've become so good at educating children just above the neck and mostly to the left side,
yeah.
you know, because all our education is left brain oriented for the most part.
Right.
And so we become really good at that because we realize that that's how, that's what's going to make us successful. But on the other side, the things that are required for the practice of LOA are so much right brain oriented. Mm. And that's why we tend to have such a hard time, you know, practicing the law of attraction most of the time, because it kind of goes against all that we've been trained and educated to do, which is to analyze, you know, to critically evaluate every situation from every possible angle and to dissect it into little bits and to look at each part separately and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, I've been trained to do that. It makes you a good scientist, quote unquote. But, you know, the right brain qualities that helps you to realize that you are connected to everyone else and that there is lots of joy and happiness and beauty all around you, that we tend to have a hard time putting into practice in our life. And so that is the challenge for us, to shift our focus or the use of our brain from the left side to the right side. The ideal situation is a balance between the two. But unfortunately, we're so left brain dominant that becomes really difficult.
You mentioned also that there is a school of thought that says there's no such thing as left brain or right brain. Touch on that for a moment.
Oh, well, I meant specifically that, you know, there are some people who say that individuals are left brain oriented and others are right brained. You know what I mean? Some people are scientists and others are artists, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And those, and the school of thought that disputes that, they said that we all have the scientist and the artist within us.
Ah, okay.
It's just cultivated out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I think there's a lot of truth to that. In my own case, I developed my left brain skills very early and very often throughout the early part of my life. And it wasn't until I was in my early 30s that I got the opportunity. Well, that's not entirely true, because I did experiment quite a bit with music in my younger years. But in terms of my work life, that was about the first time I got a chance to actually try to apply right brain. And I found that with some effort, I was able to do it pretty easily. So according to conventional thinking, I was a strongly left brain person, but I evolved into someone who had a more balanced brain as a result of that experience working with right brain activities. And the right brain activities were when I worked at an advertising agency and I was doing graphic design and you know, various kinds of advertising design and so on and so forth. So I think probably what really happened there is the right side got some development that I had not gotten before, and the left side was fully developed. So it was the right side catching up with the left side.
Exactly, yeah. In fact, the belief is that the successful, powerful people in our society who have made major contributions have found just what you're describing, the way to balance or to actually have their left brain and right brain both be maximized.
Mm-hmm.
How they operate in the world.
Right, right. Now, to me, the biggest challenge, and you kind of touched on this, is the integration of the two.
Yes.
It's getting the two to work together. Can you talk from a scientific perspective what that's about?
Yes, because, you know, the brain is made up of these neurons, you know, billions of neurons that are all connected, because, you know, it's all like these branches branching out everywhere. And your brain works best when you have a vast number of neurons all working together on the problem, you know. And we, you know, in science and education and even in the corporate world, have come to realize that. And the way they go about it is that they try to make these teams of people that come from different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So they try to put, you know, the computer scientist and the engineer and the artist and the musician all in one team to solve a problem so that they can get all the different perspectives. The ideal, of course, would be to have one person who can have all these perspectives on the problem or even on your life. But from a more technical point of view, you know, the brain is actually divided into two hemispheres, and connecting that there's the organ that's called the and the name just slipped me, Corpus, I'm going to get to it soon. But what they've realized is that when they study the brains of different people who have different skills, they found that the people who are really exceptionally talented and gifted actually have a stronger connection between the two sides of their brain, a stronger physical connection. That corpus callosum, as it's called, is actually thicker. There are more neurons running between both sides of the brains for these people. And the good thing is that you can actually cause that structure to grow.
How do you do that?
Just like what you were describing. When you, as someone who's been left brain oriented for so long, you force yourself into a right brain oriented activity. So that's why it's good for, you know, scientists and mathematicians to learn to play a musical instrument. You know, do that, those kinds of activities forces the two halves of the brain, the left side and the right side, to kind of work together, and it strengthens that connection between them. And then you can, doing that, you then develop the ability to use that skill to have both perspective on all areas of your life. So you can look at it from the logical perspective as well as from a creative perspective, and you always end up with a better solution that way.
When I was working at that advertising agency, I did not have any knowledge of the law of attraction at that point. I think actually the knowledge about neuroscience was still very much in its infancy. So even the amount of information you just described really wasn't publicly available anyway. And I suspect it probably was not heavily available even within the scientific community.
No, recent times with all the modern technology.
Right. Right. So at that point I really had to force it, using that word. I had to force myself into that situation of learning to develop the right side of my brain. But now, looking back, I'm asking myself, could I have done it without applying the force, without pushing myself into a corner, so to speak, and making it, you know, I had to, it's like being thrown into the deep end of the swimming pool and you learn how to swim that way, that kind of thing. Surely there's got to be an easier way that's less stressful and less traumatic.
Yeah, there is, because usually there is something that you are interested in and attracted to and have a passion for. So I know you like music. That's one of the best ways to kind of develop that mm-hmm. connection. And so you can, you know, there are people who have these inner passions for art or acting or singing, you know, that they kind of shy and reserved about. But those are the things, because it's something that you actually want to do, so it doesn't become something that you're forced to do.
And so really, is it? Can you think of anything in your life where you enjoy being creative? That's ultimately what it comes down to.
Right, exactly. I was wondering if you were asking me that, because I love creativity.
Well, yeah, I was asking you particularly too, but I was posing it as a formula.
Yeah, because my challenge is to be the technical, logical person, which kind of, you know, it's yeah. Anyways, that's my challenge.
Well. Ultimately, I guess I could pose the same kind of teaser to help you go in that direction. And mm-hmm. that is, on the right brain side, you're asking yourself, is there anything about which you enjoy creating? You know, is there any creative side of you there? You pointed out for me it was music, and indeed music helped me a lot when I got to the ad agency. When it came to the point where I had to start learning to develop how to create ideas for advertising out of thin air, music helped me a lot. So mm-hmm. you're absolutely 100% spot on that. But you know, to turn the whole thing around to the left brain side, that's all about finding problems to solve. It's about finding ways to apply logical scenarios and all the left brain activities. So I guess the question that I would pose to you is there any kinds of problems you like to solve?
Yeah, yes, and I would answer that by talking about some of the ways that they're trying to incorporate this information into schools for, you know, grade school kids. And, you know, because math has always been a challenge for so many kids, because math is taught so much from the left brain and left brain only.
Yes.
And so now what they're trying to do is make it they try to use a lot of pictures instead of all the words.
Mm-hmm.
So using a lot of pictures, and you know, there are lots of like computer programs now that makes solving math problems, even doing computer programming, they're teaching programming, coding, using just pictures, just mm-hmm. little cartoon characters and stuff, so that the kids can learn without having to try and be very logical and understand words and that kind of stuff. And I know for me, if you tell me a math problem with just words, then it's more challenging than if you tell me it with a story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like stories, especially if it involves people. I remember and I understand stuff about people much more readily than if it were just a dry story, just, you know, stating the facts kind of thing. So that's one of the ways that they're trying to encourage the teaching of math and science to, in particular, young girls.
Mm-hmm.
Who always tend to get turned off by it being so very technical and logical.
I can think of another area of life that virtually everybody is affected by now, where the same kind of thinking is being applied on a fairly regular basis, and that is computer devices, particularly smartphones and so forth. They're working very hard and have been working very hard for quite some time to picturize everything.
Mm-hmm.
So icons that you operate on your smartphone, that's all about making it a pictorial approach to operating a smartphone. The whole idea of a command line interface is gone.
Yeah.
Gone completely. And indeed, it's gotten to the point where they're almost swinging the pendulum a little bit too far on the other side. For instance, eBay right now, eBay is actually experimenting. And for those of you who have not used eBay, it's kind of hard to describe, but I'll lay it out for you as best I can. If you look at an individual item for sale on eBay, at the top of the page, you've got a picture of the item. You've got a title that describes what the item is. You've got the price. If it's an auction, how many people are bidding. It has that kind of information. You scroll down a little bit more. You get some more photos you can click on to view the item from different angles. And then you scroll down further and you get a fuller description that the person selling the item has written up. Well, eBay is now experimenting with hiding the full description. The only way you'll get to see it under certain circumstances is if you click a button that says, "Show me the full description." They're trying to limit it as much as they can to the visual image of what's being sold.
Okay, yeah.
So there's a practical experiment that I think actually they're probably going a little bit too far on, but nevertheless, they're trying very hard to pictorialize the internet.
Yeah, I'm just laughing because I'm thinking all the left brain people are going to think they are going too far, but the right brain people are going to think, wow, this is perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yep. So, okay, let's take this back to the law of attraction then. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately what we're trying to do is we're trying to learn how to get ourselves out of these negative traps that we're in into the positive vein, and we're trying to figure out how to use the left and right sides of our brains to accomplish that. Now, you mentioned when you were talking about the person who had suffered the stroke and her right brain basically had to take over, and she was connected to all this love and joy and so forth. That's certainly a big portion of the LOA formula, feeling all that. Yeah. So tie us in scientifically. How do we tie in and feel that joy and feel that love so that we can get the left brain in there saying, okay, here's what I need.
So that's the challenge, and that's why trying to practice law of attraction feels so outside of the norm for all of us. But they've come up with so many left brain ways to activate the right brain.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, there are books written, and I can think of specifically, we read the book about how to be happy, and she goes into great detail giving step-by-step instructions on how to be more happy in your everyday life. And I mean, it's great. It includes things like, of course, keeping a journal and trying to take note of all the happy things in your life and listening to happy stories, telling happy stories, watching great music, listening to great music, surrounding yourself with happy people. She has 7 chapters, and each chapter has a list of different things. But yeah, so those are, because you know, we have to use our left brain to help us to activate our right brain, because it's our strong suit right now. It's what we're good at, and so that's how we have to kind of go at it. And of course, we don't want to go the other way, which is get a stroke and have the left brain to be you know.
No, that's not really the most desirable way to do it.
No, it's not, because then you won't be able to count and you won't understand words and all that kind of stuff. So,
yes.
Although she did learn how to handle words, doesn't she? I mean, ultimately, the right brain can take over certain left brain functionality and vice versa.
Well, she regained use of her left brain for the most part. You know,
oh, okay.
It was a long journey. It took her years, actually. But she did. She did. You know, she had therapy and she healed and she learned how to. She had to learn how to walk and talk and all that kind of stuff again.
Yeah,
but she did. But you're right. There are cases of people actually having minor strokes, such that the parts of the brain actually is totally dead. I mean, it's gone. There's no recuperating there. And other parts of the brain have taken over the functions that that part of the brain was in charge of. So,
is it still considered a truism within the world of neuroscience that we do not utilize 90% of our brain?
No.
Okay. So, 'cause that used to be the rule of thumb. You know, we only use 5 to 10% of our brain, 90% or whatever gets unutilized. That apparently is no longer considered true. How has that been amended and changed over time?
I'm not even sure exactly where that myth came from, but you know, of course, I've heard it and I was familiar with it, and I probably repeated it sometime in the past. But
my guess is Anthony Robbins said it at some point, but I don't know.
No, don't blame Anthony Robbins.
Well, it may not have been Anthony Robbins, but somebody of that stature, somebody who was a major guru at some point, made that point, and oh my goodness, that must be true. Then it may not have been Tony Robbins. Forgive me for saying that.
Because I'm a huge fan of Tony Robbins. But
okay. He's a good guy. He really is.
Yeah, so I'm not sure where that came from. I think the idea was to convey the fact that we are all so very capable. You know, we have so much potential to our brain that we're not using. You know, we think of all the really successful and accomplished people, and we think that maybe – you know, they were born with some special ability and that allowed them to do what they're doing. And I think what they were trying to convey is that we have the hardware to do the same thing, but just never, achieved our potential in that direction.
Okay. Well, that is a better way to look at it, isn't it? Potential rather than, you know, quiescence, not using it at all.
And when you think about it, when we think about how many billions of neurons we have in our brains, and the possibilities are truly endless. Really, it is, in terms of what we can learn, what we can do, what we can accomplish. It's really amazing. So yeah, the potential is there for a whole lot more than we tend to think that we're capable of. And I, you know, somewhere along the line in our education and society, we're taught, you know, we have limits when we really don't.
Does neuroscience actually confirm the lack of limits? Can it really do that?
Yes, yes, yes. In fact, they're trying to figure out where, you know, why are we so limited? You know, where is the why do we place these limits on ourselves when the potential is there for so much more?
Okay.
Yeah, but the potential, yes, they confirm the potential.
Well, I think that's probably a good way to end it, because we're at the end of our hour. But thank you for the neuroscience lesson. As usual, it was very educational, very interesting. Yeah. And do you have one final thought you want to share with people before we sign off for the night?
You know, it's just every time we talk, I'm challenged to actually go and do more in terms of trying to make LOA more part of my life, but more specifically today, to do more right-brained activities.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's really a goal for all of us to aim for, to do more of the creative side, more of the gestalt side, more of the love and joy side, because that's where it all starts. Yeah. All right, Mark and Yuona, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure as usual, and we'll see you next week, I hope.
Yes,
yep.
We'll be here.
All right, and we'll invite you all to join us next week as well here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.
make them.